Okay, let's have a look at this. So, a letter to my former master, published in that newspaper, the one I showed you, the North Star, in 1848, in September. So who is he writing for? I'm going to I'll see if I can get you to answer some questions. Who is he writing for? Who is the audience? What do you think? Yeah.
It's targeted to his master, to his former master.
Mm-hmm.
And also, other people that I read the drummer to inspire other people to open the drummer.
Absolutely, yeah. We have it. It appears to be a letter to his master. What do you think he thinks his master will do? Nothing. If slave owners would free their slaves when they received a letter, on so il quoi? So it appears to be a letter to his master. Well, it is. But the most important, you're quite right, the most important audience is the people who read the newspaper. The people who read the newspaper, they may be reading it because they hate slavery, or because they're not very happy with slavery, but they're thinking about it. You have to see this letter as a political tactic. Imagine the front page of the North Star. Do you want to buy a newspaper about slavery? And imagine on the front page it says, page 3, statistics about the suffering of slavery in slaves in Virginia. That's good, it's interesting. But your statistics about this, yeah? But the problem is, people have heard a lot of information about slavery. How about page 3, a letter to my former master? What? It's a political tactic. It's good journalism. How do you if you want to build a campaign against slavery, you need a lot of people to be interested, and so give them interesting stuff. A letter to my former master. That's never been done. I don't know any other examples. So it was an original, in my opinion, quite brilliant idea to get everybody listening. Hey, I've written a letter to my former master. Secondly, the style. It's very literary, a little bit biblical. On dirait Robert Ballinter, hein? C'est un vrai intello, quoi. C'est, il faut se poser et le lire. Yeah? And this is tremendously important. Many, many people think, oh, slavery is okay because blacks are completely different from us. Yeah? Black people are not educated, many people said, because they don't want to be educated. They can't be educated. They're different from us. And so the actual style is part of the argument that he is showing that he was brought up a slave, and he can write better than all of you, even better than me too. Yeah. So in fact, the fact of the letter is an argument. So what does the letter say before you analyze the detail? It says, one, I have an idea to get a lot of people to read it, even people who didn't read the North Star. The other newspaper said, there is a letter from a slave to his former master in the North Star. What do we think about it? It was a political event. It was good politics. It was a good activism. So that's one thing. The second thing is that he is showing himself to be an intellectual, and he is suggesting that, well, he is demonstrating that black people are just like white people. Now, we know that, but they really didn't. Yeah. One of the important things to remember about racism, especially historical racism, is that the racists were not pretending to be racist. They really were. They were absolutely convinced that it was impossible for black people to be equal. Yeah. They weren't pretending. just because they made money out of it. It's seared into their conscience. Another thing that he shows he's an intellectual, he also shows, and we'll come into the detail in a moment, he also shows he's very Christian. In the best sense of the word. Because he says at one point, slavery causes terrible damage to the slaves, but it also causes terrible damage to slave owners. And he gives some details. I'll come to it in a moment. This is very Christian point of view. Yeah, I'm interested in myself, but also even the person who is attacking me, I'm interested in him because he has a soul too. He will go to heaven or not to heaven. And so really sort of showing this idea of Christian charity. Now, even today, this is quite important to us, even if we're not Christians. But at the time, this was really tremendously important to people. And of course, the power of the actual argument. So at the beginning, he said, at the beginning of this section, he said, "Oh, yeah, where are my sisters?" Now, it's very important to have articles that say, you know, the latest statistics show that the average life expectancy of black slaves in Virginia has gone down to 34.3. Those are very important, but it's not so moving as what he has to say immediately. At this moment, you are probably the guilty holder of at least three of my own dear sisters and my only brother in bondage. These you regard as your property. They are recorded on your ledger. Or perhaps have been sold to human fleshmongers with a view to filling your own ever hungry purse. So he accuses Mr. Auld, he's called. He accuses him of being inhuman just for money. Just for money, your ever hungry purse. And he uses some particularly negative expressions. Do you know what a monger is? Yeah. What does a monger do? Yeah.
He destroys reputation.
It's a good idea. No.
Yeah,
it's a good idea. No. A monger. What? Why would you go to see a fishmonger? To buy fish. To buy fish. Monger is a very old word. It means to sell. Today we have a few left. A fishmonger. C'est le poisson. Il n'y a pas un autre mot. C'est fishmongers. Je crois qu'il y en a que deux qui restent. Ironmongers. Ironmongers, c'est la quincaillerie. Il n'y a pas un autre mot pour ça. But the word monger you occasionally see to mean a seller. So here, fleshmongers, yet sellers of human flesh. So it's a rather disgusting word for the slave traders. And it's a slightly just because it's flesh, yeah? Yeah, les vendeurs de chair. Bon. It's a pretty negative word there. Yeah, my sisters are recorded on your ledger. What is it? What is a ledger? Anybody got the word ledger? It's a big book. It's a big book. It's just a big book. In particular, a book of accounts. Yeah, the ledger says, you know, income, expenditure. That's a ledger. And so, rather than he's going to make it very personal, instead of an article that talks about slaves in general, we have a slave talking about his sisters. Where are my sisters? This makes it very personal. And so it also makes it more interesting, but also it allows people to think about the 4 million enslaved blacks. Oh yeah, they're just like me. They like that they feel close to their sisters. It might be a bad example, sisters, because as you know, sisters can be, you know, not so great. But anyway, I have two. Yeah, big sisters. They're the worst. Yeah, do you have sisters? Oh, they're big ones too. Oh, that's pretty bad too. Yeah. Still, we prefer they're not slaves. Yeah. That would be a bit excessive as a sibling rivalry. Okay, so there you go. And so he's really going, you know, Have you sold them, or are they still in your possession? What is becoming of them? Are they living or dead? So here we have, it can be a good idea to comment on the style a little bit. So here we have something which is repetitive, because really it's the same thing, yeah? Have you sold them, or are you they still in your possession? What has become of them? Are they living or dead? It's a repetition, and it gives the impression of somebody rather desperate to have the news. And so this is about presenting the ex-slave, as a wronged human being, in appearance to appeal to the better nature of the slave owner. But I don't think he had any illusions. I don't think he thought, oh, I'll write a letter to my owner and then he'll send me my sisters. Yeah, he's not a stupid man. Yeah. So it's a device, it's a journalistic device. And then he moves on to his grandmother. If my grandmother be still alive, and my dear old grandmother, whom you turned out like an old horse to die in the woods, is she still alive? Write and let me know all about them. So again, he's almost like playing a game. He said, please write and tell me about them. Now, he knows that the slave owner will not write to tell him anything. But it's to show what the distance between a normal human being and the relationship of slave to slave owner. So that's what he's doing. So here is when you're working on the thing, you're trying to think, well, why did he make this choice? Why is he doing that? And remember, you're allowed to speculate. If you're not sure, you can say, oh, he might be trying this. That's fine. You're allowed to speculate. What you must not do is ignore the question of what he's trying to do. You must talk about the question of what he's trying to do. That's the centre. That's the centre. If my grandmother be still alive, she is of no service to you, for by this time she must be nearly 80 years old, too old to be cared for by one to whom she has ceased to be of service. Send her to me at Rochester, or bring her to Philadelphia, and it shall be the crowning happiness of my life to take care of her in her old age. Oh, she was to me a mother and a father, so far as hard toil for my comfort could make her such. Send me my grandmother, that I may watch over and take care of her in her old age. And my sisters, let me know all about them. Again, he's being repetitive, he's sounding emotional. Although it's quite crafted, I mean, he's a professional, you know, it's quite crafted about it. And it's also perhaps showing that the system is so cruel that even though the grandmother is no use anymore as a slave, she cannot work anymore, nevertheless, the slave owner cannot allow himself to be human. He moves on to another question, and this is the question of education. Now, there will be many articles in the North Star now saying, only 5% of enslaved people in the South can read, and this is because of this law and this law. And these are interesting and important articles. But this, what he says here, makes it much more human. He doesn't say, it's not fair, black people have no education. He says, you have taken away from me the possibility of writing to my sister and receiving letters to my sister. You have destroyed a relationship which was possible. So he's making the slavery situation very personal and very human, because he thinks that it will be even more effective than an ordinary article, that there will be a few more people. He's an activist. He knows that, you know, a lot of people read newspapers and do nothing. But he's hoping that in this way there will be a few more people who will come to the meetings and put pressure on and join the movement and so on, and eventually this will be solved in the civil war. And my sisters, let me know all about them. I would write to them and learn all I want to know of them, without disturbing you in any way, but that through your unrighteous conduct, they have been entirely deprived of the power to read and write. You have kept them in utter ignorance, And you have therefore robbed them of the sweet enjoyments of writing or receiving letters from absent friends and relatives.
Aujourd'hui, il faut penser. Il a enlevé la possibilité d'envoyer des textos pour les anniversaires, mais ou quelque chose. C'est vrai que writing letters, ça a vraiment disparu. C'est assez impressionnant. Hein. Quand j'avais votre âge, j'écrivais 4 lettres par semaine. Et ce n'est pas courant, mais c'est, bien sûr, je ne le fais plus. Parce que les emails, on a écrit 3 phrases parce que c'est trop immédiat. Hein. Enfin, c'est différent. C'est différent. On fait d'autres choses à la place. On joue à Wordle.
Okay. Your wickedness and cruelty committed in this respect of your fellow creatures are greater than all the stripes you have laid upon my back or theirs. So what he is saying here is that slavery is very cruel, and the flogging, whipping, yeah, he talks about the stripes you have laid upon my back. This is flogging, which is extremely bloody. You don't want to see a film of it. It's really, really bloody, and people sometimes die of it. It's amazing, actually, that people often don't die of it, actually, because it's just so bloody. But he says, it is even worse than flogging is to stop people from learning to read or write. And again, he is thinking of his audience. Or a lot of his most interesting audience are people who say, well, you know, I don't really like slavery. Well, you know, black people can't be educated, I know that. I know black people are inferior, but I don't like slavery. And so he's trying to bring them little by little, give them more arguments, give them more ideas about the fact that human beings are human beings. And he does this by himself being a slave and writing about the worst thing is not to be able to read and write and communicate. It is an outrage upon the soul, a war upon the immortal spirit, and one for which you must give account at the bar of our common Father and Creator. Now, in this case, the bar is not the place where you buy a pint of beer with God. No, this is another kind of bar. This is a bar of a tribunal. In the tribunal, you say, yes, the witness will go to the bar, and the bar is the place where you stand to speak. Yeah. And so, in this case, according to Christian ideology, as you know, that when you die, you don't say, hi, God. Oh, I guess I was wrong. I'm an atheist. Sorry. And then you explain all the good things you've done, and cross your fingers, and you might get away with it. You never know. And so he is using. He's saying that really, if you're a Christian, Mr. Auld, you should repent. It is a terrible sin what you have done to stop my sisters from being able to read and write. Okay, I'm going to continue with that in just a moment, but first of all, I want to tell you a few more things about Frederick Douglass and his life. If I haven't mixed up my my notes without possibility of changing. Yes. So yes, a little bit more about Douglass's life as himself. Oof, loads of things here. Yes, he doesn't know who his father is, but it may be that his master was his father. This was tremendously common at the time.
Can I ask
him? Yes, of course. That's what I'm paid for.
Children born from slaves, slaves and slave masters together, because slaves were raped.
Yes.
Were these children still counted as slaves?
Absolutely.
The father was aware
that. Absolutely. Absolutely. And indeed, there was a problem with this because a problem for the racist. Because from time to time, you would have slave masters who would be the father of a child with a slave, and they would, you know, they would become a little close to them, and they say, well, you know, I want to make him officially part of my family, and you know, and leave him things when I die. And some of the parliaments made this illegal. Yeah, that slaves were not allowed to be integrated in that way. So it was considered to be a real danger. But in general, the slave owners preferred to forget the children. Yeah. But yeah, absolutely. If you were born from a slave mother, you were a slave. It didn't matter who your father was. So yeah, not fun. And yes. It is a case of rape, of course, because a slave cannot possibly consent. If you are the property of somebody, how can you possibly consent? You know, it's like a small child. You know, from an ethical point of view, you cannot imagine having any sort of equal relationship. So when he was 12 years old. Frederick Douglass, when he was 12 years old, he began to learn to read and write. And it was his master's wife who taught him. Until one day the master said that this was forbidden. Yeah, he said that, you know, if you teach a slave to read and write, he will never accept to be a slave. Which is, you know, probably quite likely and probably quite a good thing. However, he continued to he had been extremely poor when he was young and hungry, and he began working as a slave when he was 12. And after the master's wife would no longer teach him, he managed to get help from local white children. He would give them a bit of food, and they would teach him to read and write. And of course, what they read and write mostly was the Bible. And the Bible was there. And all his life, his writings and his speeches were very much influenced by the language of the Bible. When he was a little later, he managed to organize a secret. When he was, it's like 14 years old, 16 years old. He organized a secret Sunday school for slaves to learn to read and write. Quite often the slaves would, they often did not work on the Sunday, or not so much on a Sunday, and the masters imagined that they would just drink whiskey and dance, but he organized a secret slave Sunday school, and he had more than 30 slaves learning to read and write. He was not obedient enough for his master, and when he was 15, he was sent to Edward Covey, a slave breaker. So what happened here is that many of the slave owners, they had, you know, 10 slaves or 6 slaves, if they had a slave who was troublesome, who was not obedient enough, but they themselves did not feel cruel enough, there were specialists in every town who specialized in being slave breakers, who were even crueler than everybody else, and they sent him off to this other person for a few months with the hope of succeeding in demoralizing him. And of course, this would sometimes succeed. When he was 19 years old, when Frederick Douglass was 19 years old, he fell in love with a black woman, Anna Murray, who was a free woman. Because in the towns there were a certain number of free black people, either because occasionally their masters had freed them, or they had saved money and bought their freedom, or the church had bought their freedom. There were lots of possibilities. So he fell in love with a free black woman, but he said I don't want to marry you while I'm a slave, and so he ran away north dressed as a sailor when he was 20 years old. He went to Pennsylvania, which was one of the states where the anti-slavery movement was the strongest, and then his wife came to join him. This is what he said about that. He actually wrote during his life 3 autobiographies, and this is what he said. Okay, see you next week. I have often been asked how I felt when I first found myself on free soil. And my readers may share the same curiosity. There is scarcely anything in my experience about which I could not give a more satisfactory answer. A new world had opened upon me. If life is more than breath, I lived more in one day than in a year of slave life. Now, at this point, he had run away, but he could still be captured and sent back. And so he was certainly very courageous to join the anti-slavery movement as a speaker. And in 1843, so when he's 25, he joined other speakers in the American Anti-Slavery Society's project, which was called 100 Conventions. And the 100 Conventions was a six-month tour of the eastern and midwestern United States, where they organized 100 public meetings in 100 towns against slavery. So this was a big campaign, very determined people. And I think there's one thing that we often forget, and it's absolutely essential to remember, they did not know that they were going to win. Because, you know, of course, we know they're going to win. So, don't worry, you'll be fine. In 20 years, there'll be a civil war and slavery will be over. But, of course, what is impressive about these people is that year after year they continue. And they did not know they were going to win. Slavery could have continued for many hundreds of, for many decades more. So off they went to the 100 conventions tour. This could be dangerous. You know, they're arriving in towns where they probably mostly towns where where are we here? Massachusetts. But these are mostly towns where there are no slaves. But you know, there are still a lot of people who are in favour. This is the local plaques. In 1843, Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society sent speakers to New York State, Pennsylvania State, and Ohio State, and Indiana to hold 100 conventions on abolition. When speakers encountered citizens with deeply held racist ideas, they were often targets of violence. On September the 18th, a crowd gathered near here to listen to George Bradman, William A. White, and Frederick Douglass. During Bradman's speech, more than 30 men marched in armed with stones and brickbats and demanded that the speakers leave. In the assault that followed, White, Douglass, and others were injured. Local supporters defended them and carried them to safety. And Frederick Douglass was injured and he never recovered. His arm was never again the same. Yeah, his hand was broken. Frederick Douglass's best known work is his first autobiography, Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, which I read last week, actually, really. Very, very, very good. And he had a particular problem, which appears again in this letter. When they published this letter, a lot of the racists said, it's not true, it's a fake. A slave could not write like that. And this was one of the reasons it was so important for him to go around the country and speak so people could see him. Obviously not a fake, because you can see him. Whereas people accused him, both when he was writing the autobiography, they accused it of being a fake, yeah, that he, no black person could write that. And the same thing with the letter to my former master. Now, at this point, they had a problem because he was becoming rather well known with his autobiography. And people said, well, what if they come and try to get him and take him back to slavery? And so they. Another one of these stories, one of his friends said, oh, you know, we need somebody to do a tour of Britain to explain the situation in Britain. Why don't you go tomorrow? It's really like get out of here now, and he went to then indeed to England, and this is what he says when he arrives in England. Ireland. He's arrived in Ireland, which is part of the British of the United Kingdom at the time, of course. 11 days and a half gone, and I have crossed 3,000 miles of the perilous deep. Instead of a democratic government, I am under a monarchical government. Instead of the bright blue sky of America, I am covered with the soft grey fog of the Emerald Isle of Ireland. I breathe, and lo, the chattel becomes a man. I gaze around in vain for one who will question my equal humanity, who will claim me as his slave or offer me an insult. I employ a cab. I am seated beside white people. I reach the hotel. I enter the same door. I am shown into the same parlour. I dine at the same table, and no one is offended. I find myself regarded and treated at every turn with the kindness and deference paid to white people. When I go to church, I am met by no upturned nose. So, tremendously good writer, obviously, but also a tremendously expressive moment for him, an emotional moment for him. It's when he goes back, he stays for 2 years in the United Kingdom, and during this time, some of his friends say, the situation is too dangerous for you to go back to America, so we have contacted your master and we are going to buy you. We're going to pay your master the money. Difficult to say thank you to people when they do that, isn't it? It's so disgusting. And that's what they did. So they bought his freedom. And so then he could go back to America safely. But that was the horrific situation. And it's just after that, when he goes back to America, 1848, that he writes a letter to his former master. Just a little bit about the end, the rest of his life. After the Civil War, there are two important events. First of all, Douglas is the only black person to attend the Seneca Falls Convention. The Seneca Falls Convention is the first women's right convention in the United States, the first one, asking for the right to vote for women. And Frederick Douglass was the only black person present. And he spoke in favour of that. Later, things got politically a little difficult after the Civil War. So Frederick Douglass was, of course, a great supporter of the Civil War. He said it's essential, the North must win, and slavery must be abolished. After the Civil War, there was still a fight for a couple of years because it wasn't clear that black people were going to get the right to vote. And eventually, there was a big political argument because I think it's the 14th Amendment. Yes, the 15th Amendment gave black men the right to vote, but women did still not have the right to vote. And here there was a division within the women's movement, with some people saying, we must support the 15th Amendment, which gives black men the right to vote. Firstly, because if more people have the right to vote, that's a step closer to our aims. And secondly, because of the importance of racism. But a whole section of the women said, no, we must refuse the amendment which will give black men the right to vote if women are not included. And at this point, there was a division. And I think that probably this section had not understood how racism was at the centre of American society. But that's my opinion. And I wasn't there. I'm very old, but I wasn't there at that time. Yeah. I think those are the most important things I wanted to say. So let me have a look at the second paragraph, which we looked at, which I asked you to read a moment ago. First of all, any questions? Now is a good time for questions. Any time is a good time for questions, but for now, for example. Okay, well, let's have a look. Good. This is what you're paid for. Well.
Well, the
statistics that I saw was around 1,000 slaves a year successfully escaped. Okay. So I don't know how many failed, Probably more, I would think, yeah. But it's interesting that the Underground Railroad, because once the abolition movement became quite strong, that they had special secret places where you could hide. And this is what we call the Underground Railroad, and this is what Harriet Tubman was most famous for, organising the Underground Railroad. But it must have been, heartbreaking for everybody, because you can run away and leave your mother and your sisters and your brothers and, you know, okay, brothers, okay, but you know, mothers and sisters, you know, I mean, you know, the whole story is just full of heartbreaking things, yes.
After slavery was abolished, was there like a whole movement from former slave owners that the slavery will be brought back?
No, because they had lost the Civil War, yeah, and so they were more pragmatic than that. They said, you know, okay, I don't think they ever thought that they could get slavery back. They said, okay, what do we need to do? We need to, you know, make sure that black people don't vote, even if they have the right to vote. And this is the time, 20 years later, is the time of the Ku Klux Klan. Of the Ku Klux Klan, whose aim is to terrify all of the black population, so that even though they're not slaves, they will still serve the interests of the white owners. Yeah, but no, I think they have a certain. I think they had a certain political realism, and because that became the central question of the Civil War, and so no, I don't think they thought that it was going to come back. Good question, though. One more question? Yep, you must always interrupt me for questions, or I will just talk all the time. That's what I do easily. The responsibility which you have assumed in this regard is truly awful, and how you could stagger under it these many years is marvellous. Your mind must have become darkened, your heart hardened, your conscience seared and petrified, or you would have long since thrown off the accursed load and sought relief at the hands of a sin-forgiving God. So there's a couple of difficult words here. First of all, in the first line, they're awful. It's not the modern meaning of the word. It means literally awful. It means tremendous, enormous. Yeah, époustouflant, si vous voulez. And so it's an interesting point here. He's saying, you know, I don't understand how is it possible to have the attitude of a slave owner? That's what he's saying. Especially because you like me believe in God. He says, you know, and so here he's talking about the terrible effects, in his opinion, which slavery has on the slave owner. Your mind becomes dark, your heart becomes hard, your conscience is seared and petrified. To sear, now what the thing you usually sear is a steak. Yeah? If you have a nice steak, when you want to cook it, first of all you sear it very, very hot for 1 minute on each side. That's searing, it's burning. And then you turn the heat down to cook the rest of it, and then you add the Roquefort sauce, and never mind. Okay, that's not the essential. So your conscience must be burnt and petrified. Your conscience must be burnt and turned to stone. Yeah? So this is an interesting point. Again, it's not, we don't always see this in politics. You know, let's look, I mean, you know, even today, if you read an anti-racist article, it doesn't usually say, let's look at the horrible things that racism does to racists. Yeah, that's what we normally think of. So it's a very Christian point of view, but also I think there is something specific about slavery, because it's very personal. Now, it's not like, you know, if you're a factory owner and you pay women much less than men. It's not personal. Slavery is about being the personal property of somebody. So it's psychologically much more damaging, mostly for the slave. But also, I think, yeah, I think Frederick Douglass knows what he's talking about more than me. He says, you know, that you must be petrified. You must become very inhuman, because if you were a normal human being, then you would have said, "Oh, I'm not going to own slaves anymore. Instead, I'm going to free my slaves and go to church and ask God for forgiveness." Now, of course, again, he has in mind the people who are reading his newspaper, because he's not expecting to. Although there is a postscript to this, because a number of years later, after the Civil War, do anybody know the end of the story? Well, he is giving a meeting against slavery, not against slavery, against something else, for the rights of black people or something. And a woman comes up to him afterwards. Oh, no, sorry, let me get this right. I'm sorry, I got it wrong. Before the Civil War. So he's giving a meeting against slavery. And a woman comes up to him afterwards and says, "I am Mr. Ould's daughter, the daughter of his former owner. And she is an abolitionist, and she's involved with it." And so he gets to know her. And a few years later, when Mr. Ould is dying, the daughter asks Frederick Douglass to go and visit him. And Frederick Douglass says, okay. And he goes to visit his owner, his former owner, when Mr. Ould is dying. Now, we don't know what they said, you know. Maybe he just kicked him. Probably not, because he wasn't that sort of guy. So, but this would be very much in keeping with his Christian idea that even in this extreme situation of injustice, if a dying person has to see you, you go to see them. But, so, I mean, the whole story is just so impressive because, you know, I mean, instead of going to his former owner's house and slitting his throat, he writes him a letter and talks about how to it. Well, that's how I see it anyway. Thank you for listening to so carefully. That's enough for this week. And next week, we're going to be talking about Emmeline Pankhurst, and we will be back in Britain.